Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
It is Friday. This is Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the most, the radio chick, along with my debonair, my suave, sophisticated, and oh-so-intellectual co-host, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Where'd you get that accent from all of a sudden? You haven't had an accent for a year. Glad to be here.
Yeah, and we do expect our guest to show up today, Evan Sayet. He's a comedian off of the Left Coast. He's got the longest-running conservative comedy show, believe it or not, in Los Angeles. Man, we've got a huge, huge amount of stuff for today. There's so much that's been going on, and I don't even know where to begin.
We'll start at the beginning, and we'll work our way down.
All right, those that have...
The big news is President Obama picked Indiana to win a national championship, given the fact that they're ranked number one in the country, and they have been most of the year. What a surprise.
As if I would give a flying whoop in the rain. That's news.
As if anyone would.
We've got so much going on with the sequestration, with his visit to Israel, which was a... absolute disaster, the gun battle. You know, there's so much more going on here that he's got to worry about who's going to win, you know, the final four. Who cares? You know, take care of the country.
Yeah.
You know, after now it's going on 6 years, just try to do your job just once.
That's what it is. That is the job, shaking hands and predicting scores.
Yeah, and campaigning for more money. Oh, geez. You know, it's enough to drive you absolutely to drink. Oh, man. You know, those that listen to our show know that we start off each show with a dedication to a fallen hero. And today, The intention was to dedicate it solely to Army Chief Warrant Officer 3rd Corey J. Goodnature. But the more I began to look into the situation where he was killed in action, the more I realized that 18 others died that day, and it all surrounded the action he was responding to. And it would not be proper if I honored only him and disregarded the other 18. So this goes out to 19 people, 19 of our service members that were killed on June 28th, 2005. And Mike, I can't do background music because some of them were Army, some of them were Navy. I don't want to do this with disrespect to any of them. So I'm just going to read it straight, okay?
Let's go.
All right. This is from a post titled Operation Red Wings Observance. A brief history of Operation Red Wings. On June 28, 2005, deep behind enemy lines east of Azabad in the Hindu Kush of Afghanistan, very committed four-man Navy SEAL team was conducting a reconnaissance mission at the unforgiving altitude of approximately 10,000 feet. The SEALs, Lieutenant Michael Murphy, Gunner's Mate Second Class SEAL Danny Dietz, Sonar Technician Second Class SEAL Matthew Axelson, and Hospital Corpsman Second Class SEAL Marcus Luttrell, had a vital task. The four SEALs were scouting Ahmed Shah, a terrorist in his mid-30s who grew up in the adjacent mountains just to the south. Under the assumed name of Mohammed Ismail, Shah led a guerrilla group known to locals as the Mountain Tigers that aligned with the Taliban and other militant groups close to the Pakistani border. The SEAL mission was compromised when the team was spotted by local nationals who presumably reported its presence and location to the Taliban. A fierce firefight erupted between the four SEALs and a much larger enemy force of more than 50 anti-coalition militia. The enemy had the SEALs outnumbered. They also had terrain advantage. They launched a well-organized three-sided attack on the SEALs. The firefight continued relentlessly as the overwhelming militia forced the team deeper into a ravine. Trying to reach safety, the four men, now each wounded, began bounding down the mountain's steep sides, making leaps of 20 to 30 feet. Approximately 45 minutes into the fight, pinned down by overwhelming forces, Dietz, the communications petty officer, sought open air to place a distress call back to the base. But before he could, he was shot in the hand, the blast shattering his thumb. Despite the intensity of the firefight and suffering grave gunshot wounds himself, Murphy is credited with risking his own life to save the lives of his teammates. Murphy intent on making contact with headquarters, but realizing this would be impossible in the extreme terrain where they were fighting, unhesitantly and with complete disregard for his own life, moved into the open, where he could gain a better position to transmit a call to get help for his men. Moving away from the protective mountain rocks, he knowingly exposed himself to increased enemy gunfire. This deliberate and heroic act deprived him of cover and made him a target for the enemy. While continuing to be fired upon, Murphy made contact with the SOF Quick Reaction Force at Bagram Air Base and requested assistance. He calmly provided his unit's location and the size of the enemy force, while requesting immediate support for his team. At one point, he was shot in the back, causing him to drop the transmitter. Murphy picked it back up, completed the call, and continued firing at the enemy who was closing in. Severely wounded, Lieutenant Murphy returned to his cover position with his men and continued the battle. An MH-47 Chinook helicopter with eight additional SEALs and eight Army Night Stalkers aboard was sent in as part of an extraction mission to pull out the four embattled SEALs. The MH-47 was escorted by a heavily armored Army attack helicopters. Entering a hot combat zone, attack helicopters are usually initially to neutralize the enemy and make it safer for the lightly armored personnel transport helicopter to insert. The heavy weight of the attack helicopters slowed the formation's advance, prompting the MH-47 to outrun their armored escort. They knew the tremendous risk going into an active enemy area in daylight without their attack support and without the cover of night. Risk would, of course, be minimized if they put the helicopter down in a safe zone. But knowing that their warrior brothers were shot, surrounded, and severely wounded, the rescue team opted to directly enter the oncoming battle in hopes of landing on brutally hazardous terrain. As the Chinook raced to the battle, a rocket-propelled grenade struck the helicopter, killing all 16 men aboard. On the ground and nearly out of ammunition, the four SEALs, Murphy, Luttrell, Dietz, and Axelson, continued the fight. By the end of the two-hour gunfight that careened through the hills and over cliffs, Murphy, Axelson, and Dietz had been killed. An estimated 35 Taliban were also dead. The fourth SEAL, Luttrell, was blasted over a ridge by a rocket-propelled grenade and was knocked unconscious. Regaining consciousness some time later, Luttrell managed to escape, badly injured, and slowly crawl away down the side of a cliff. Dehydrated and with a bullet wound to one leg, shrapnel embedded in both legs, three vertebrae cracked. The situation for Luttrell was grim. Rescue helicopters were sent in, but he was too weak and injured to make contact. Traveling seven miles on foot, he evaded the enemy for nearly a day. Gratefully, local nationals came to his aid, carrying him to a nearby village, where they kept him for 3 days. The Taliban came to the village several times, demanding that Luttrell be turned over to them. The villagers refused. One of the villagers made his way to a Marine outpost with a note from Luttrell, and U.S. forces launched a massive operation that rescued him from enemy territory on July 2nd. By his undaunted courage, intrepid fighting spirit, and inspirational devotion to his men in the face of certain death, Lieutenant Murphy was able to relay the position of his unit, an act that ultimately led to the rescue of Luttrell and the recovery of the remains of the three who were killed in battle. This was the worst single U.S. forces death toll since Operation Enduring Freedom nearly 6 years ago. It was the single largest loss of life for naval special warfare since World War II. The naval special warfare community will forever remember June 28, 2005, and the heroic efforts and sacrifices of our special operators. We hold with reverence the ultimate sacrifice they made while engaged in that fierce fight on the front lines of the global war on terrorism. Never to be forgotten, Lieutenant Michael P. Murphy, Sergeant Second Class Matthew Axelson, Gunnery Danny Dietz, FFC Jacques J. Fontaine, SEAL Daniel R. Healy, Lieutenant Commander Eric S. Christensen, ET-1 Jeffrey A. Lucas, Lieutenant Michael M. McGreevy, Jr., QM-2, James E. Sue, Hospital Corpsman Jeffrey S. Taylor, MM-2, Shane L. Patton, Sergeant Seamus O. Gore, Chief Warrant Officer 3rd, Corey J. Goodnature, Sergeant Kip A. Jacoby, Specialist Marcus V. Morales, Master Sergeant James W. Ponder III, Major Stephen C. Reich, Specialist Michael R. Russell, Chief Warrant Officer 4th, Chris J. Schirkenbach. To these men and their bravery, we are forever grateful. And to them and to all who serve, we dedicate the song by Todd Allen Herndon, My Name is America. God bless to all.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend.
Alan Herndon, My Name is America, dedicated to the 19 brave men that were killed in action in Iraq on June 28, 2005. We've got a great show here today. Unfortunately, my co-host, his phone dropped off, so hopefully he'll be able to call right back in. And we have our guest with us, Evan Sayet. He wrote the book, The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks and Why He Thinks Ignorance is Bliss. And he's got the longest running conservative comedy show in L.A. called The Right to Laugh. Good afternoon, Evan.
Hi, Annie. And by the way, you losing a co-host may be bad for you, but it's good for me. It needs more time for me to speak.
As if you're ever at a loss for words.
Well, that's my job. If I'm at a loss for words, I'm out of a job.
Now, you just came back from CPAC. Were you one of the speakers there?
You know, this is the first time in a long time I haven't been because I wasn't sure I would attend. But I certainly got an opportunity to go around, speak to a lot of people, attend a lot of functions. I love Radio Row because I get to just go one after another after another. You know, for a man who, as you pointed out, is never at a loss for words, that's a dream gig.
Now, I'm just curious, what is your opinion? Because Obama recently went to Israel, and I was on a guest of another the show that my co-host also goes on. All right, Cool Mike, what's Jermaine's show again? I forgot the name of it. I just flew right out of my head. Conservative Primetime. And there was a guest on there who calls himself One Angry Jew, and he and I went head-to-head, where I just couldn't understand the willingness of someone, especially of a Jewish background, not willing to defend Israel.
Yeah, I assume that he was a liberal. Am I correct? One Angry Jew?
No, he's very conservative, a constitutionalist.
Well, I have a hard time. If he's absolutely a constitutionalist, you know, then that means he's putting the Constitution above his faith and his values and his beliefs, because the left is antithetical to Judaism, and this president is I'm going to choose my words carefully, but then explain. I believe this president is a Jew hater. And it's not because of the skin on their bones. It's not because of the blood in their veins. But if you are a liberal, if you are so open-minded that no culture is better than any other, then how do you explain the history of the Jews? If the Jewish culture isn't better in some way, then how is it the longest surviving culture in all of human history? How is it that wherever the Jews have been throughout the course of time, if they're not being horrifically oppressed, they tend to thrive? How is it that the nation, just as God said, by the way, just as the Bible said, the nation that treats the Jews the best in history, America, is the most successful nation in all of human history? And, of course, how do you explain, and this is the big deal right now, how do you explain in the Middle East, if the Arab and the Israeli cultures are equally good and equally right, how do you explain the success of Israel? How do you explain their gleaming skyscrapers? How do you explain the long list of Nobel Prize-winning physicists, the technological advances that come out of this tiny state, and the abject poverty and the abject failure of the people in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? Well, if Israel, if the Jews aren't culturally superior, if there's nothing better about the Ten Commandments than about Islam, if there's nothing better about the Israeli culture, if there's nothing better about democracy and freedom and liberty, then the only explanation is that somehow the Jews have stolen the prosperity of the equally good Arabs.
Wow. Oh, man. You know, he also, I'm getting this from, oh, Jesus, this was in the Telegraph. The Weekly Standard reported that Barack Obama took part in a joint press conference with President Abbas on the West Bank under a beaming banner of Yasser Arafat. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, what is he thinking?
What he's thinking is, you have to remember, the modern liberal will invariably side with evil over good. Okay? Here you have a corrupt terrorist dictator, Yasser Arafat, the father of modern terrorism. So, of course, Barack Obama adores him. You see, if everybody is equally decent, then the guy who commits evil must have been provoked. And the guy who commits greater evil must have been greatly provoked. So they adore this mass murdering terrorist because he must have been provoked to commit those crimes.
Yeah, that was one of the things that one angry Jew was saying, that we were responsible for all the murders, and I just couldn't understand that.
Well, because by definition, you have to believe that everybody is equally good and every culture is equally right. You know, the same thing, my latest speech to the Heritage Foundation uses my unified field theory of liberalism to explain how and why the mainstream media has gotten every story in the last 60 years exactly the opposite of the truth. And a good example is they're reporting out of the Middle East, where their reportage says the storyline is that the Jews are provoking the lovely terrorists into their act, just like your friend or just like the one angry Jew. They have to be provoking them because they have to start their thinking by saying the Arabs want peace. Because everybody wants peace. If they don't want peace, then they're bad people. But they're not allowed to believe that they're bad people. So when they do bad things, they must find something to explain how they were provoked. So instead of actually listening to and reporting on the speeches made in Arabic and the things that they teach the Palestinian children in their schools, they ignore those things that have nothing to do with why they're committing their atrocities. And they will find, they'll look over, they'll search, and they'll find that a Jew built an extension on his house in Jerusalem, and that's why they're blowing up buses in Israel. There has to be an explanation, because otherwise the terrorists are bad.
right. I'm not criticizing this gentleman. All I'm just trying to do is trying to understand his viewpoint and why he has it.
I'm criticizing him, and I'm telling you why he has it. You know, Annie, there's a reason that I went to Washington a few years ago, a complete political unknown, because I wasn't in politics. I was a television writer and a stand-up comedian, but I had a theory about why my colleagues in Hollywood, smart, decent, loving, caring people, would make the most ridiculous arguments, always to protect the evil, the failed, and the wrong. So this is the explanation. My unified field theory of liberalism, which I delivered for the first time in 2007, was so right on that out of all the speeches ever given to the Heritage Foundation, mine is now the most viewed in their entire history. Because somebody saw it and said, oh my gosh, yes, that's right. And they sent it to their friends and they said, you must watch this. And they watched it and they sent it to their friends and said, yes, this is right. The answer is very simply this. There are four laws to the unified field theory of liberalism, which is in my book, The Kindergarten of Eden. I'm going to give you the first one the way it's written, and then I'll explain it. The first law of the unified field theory of liberalism, as I wrote it, is they were raised to believe that indiscriminateness is a moral imperative because its opposite is discrimination. And in the 1980s, by no coincidence, exactly when the first children of the 60s began to reach their positions of greatest power and influence in academia, in journalism, in the entertainment industry, in the 1980s, thinking was officially outlawed. Right? It was deemed a hate crime by these children of the 60s, and they taught it to the children from their birth, but most essentially when they entered kindergarten, which is when they could get their hands on everybody's children for the first time. That's why my book is called The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks. And they told them that thinking is an act so heinous that it must be avoided by all moral people and hated when seen practiced by others. Right? The idea behind the outlawing of thinking is this. Anything that an individual believes, any individual, every individual, anything you think is going to have been so tainted by your personal prejudices. Prejudices we all have. Prejudices we can't help but have is simply part of the human condition. Like prejudice is based on things like the color of your skin, the nation of your ancestry, your height, your weight, your sex, and so on. Anything the individual believes is going to be so tainted by his personal prejudices that the only way not to be an evil bigot is to never think at all. Like your friend, when he comes to this conclusion that where he says that we are responsible for all the attacks, didn't sit, do a project, some research, an effort, think, and weigh, and come to that conclusion. That's a knee-jerk kindergartner's belief that the bully is really secretly a nice guy who was provoked by certain things. Like, so the first law of the unified field theory of liberalism is that indiscriminateness is a moral imperative because its opposite is discrimination. The second law is that indiscriminate thought does not lead to indiscriminate policy. It leads invariably, Annie, inevitably. There is nowhere else it can lead but to the modern liberal siding with evil over good, wrong over right, and the behaviors that lead to failure over those that lead to success. Why? Because if no nation, no culture, no person, no behavior, if nothing is better than anything else, then success is unjust. Why should Israel succeed if it's not better than the Islamic and the Palestinian world? Failure, as proved by nothing other than the fact that it has failed, is proof positive that the failure has somehow been victimized. After all, why should the Palestinians be living in such abject poverty if they're not lesser than anybody else? So it becomes a moral imperative. It's called social justice for the liberal to try to punish the successful who stole their success, as proved by their success, and to reward the failure who has been victimized, as proved by nothing other than the fact that he has failed.
It's amazing.
Yasser Arafat didn't fail. He died. He was worth, I think, $4 billion.
It's not the individual. It's not the individual. Yes, he did fail. He failed to behave in a way that led his people to success. He failed to lead in the way, and he was evil. The fact that he conducted the evil act that he did, blowing up children in kindergarten classes in Ma'alat, the fact that he was evil is what makes the Democrat adore him. because if he does bad, then he must have been provoked, and if he does evil, then he must have been greatly provoked. So he's a martyr, as proved by his evil.
And it's like everything is turned completely upside down.
Absolutely, 180 degrees is what I say in the book. The modern liberal is not just always wrong. Excuse me, he's as wrong can be, diametrically opposed to all that is good, right, and successful. And there's a reason for it. Follow the unified theory. Success is proof positive of an injustice. Then great success is proof positive of a great injustice. And at a certain point, great and sustained success proves not only great and sustained injustice, but that this injustice was intentional and part of an evil conspiracy. Why? Think about this. Let's say you're playing roulette. No number is supposed to be better than any other number. Every number should have an equally good chance of coming up the winner. So on a spin, if one number comes up the winner and some people win and some people lose, well, that's not fair, but it's not a big deal either. But now what if the same number comes up 10 times in a row? So the same people win, the same people lose. Well, that might not yet prove conspiracy, but it's a cosmic injustice that just shouldn't happen. And you can see the losers looking over at the winner's pile and going, you didn't build that, and demanding some income redistribution. But now what if that same number comes up 100 times in a row and the same people win and the same people lose? Well, now you don't even have to know how the game was rigged. It's simply a given that the game was rigged. So what the more successful somebody is, the more that they must have committed some sort of evil. So, yes, the good becomes the worst. The great becomes the worst. The good becomes bad. And, yes, it flip-flops everything 180 degrees. And can I give you another example?
Sure.
Barack Obama was asked, do you believe in American exceptionalism? He gave a very clever, very politic answer in which he said yes, but then went on to make it very clear he meant no. He said, yes, I believe in American exceptionalism, just as I'm sure the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism. In other words, he doesn't believe America is exceptional because he used his intellect. He studied the different constitutions and forms of governance and historical ethics and whatnot. It's basically rah-rah for the home team. I happen to live here. If I lived there, I would think they were exceptional. It's almost a form of bigotry. I think America is better because I live here. But if America isn't exceptional, then how is Barack Obama to explain America's success? How is he to explain our economic prosperity, that our military strength, all our ingenuity and creativity? Well, all those things, if we're nothing special, they're unjust that we're this rich. And given that we are the richest nation in all of human history, he has no choice but to believe that America is the greatest injustice in all of human history. So, and the better and more successful we are, the more evil he has to believe us to be. Now, at this point, the job of the liberal comes to create or discover or cherry pick or spin that thing that we did that proves he stole our prosperity. You know, it was imperialism. America's not an imperialist nation. We're exactly the opposite of an imperialist nation. But that's what they teach in our schools because they're not allowed to teach that America is exceptional. That might just be their bigotries.
Yeah, it's funny, though. That's the program that they put out there, but it's not the program that their leaders believe in, especially someone like Michael Moore. You've got someone out there that's preaching this very, very doctrine, but lives completely opposite of it. So it's good for everyone else, but I don't have to follow it.
No, you don't, but it's interesting. And in my book, and let me plug in again, by the way, it was up to number 3 at one point. I think it's at number 9 in its category on Amazon. And if you know Bill Riddle, if you're a Bill Riddle fan, he says it's the most important book I've read in the last 10 years. And in the book, I actually explain why that is, why liberals exempt themselves from the, and the answer is this. If you look at the professions that we associate with liberalism, academia, journalism, governance, and what am I leaving out? My field, entertainment. Every single one of them is an industry where you don't actually ever do anything. Every one of them is an industry where the entire product is words. And when you don't do anything, you don't cause any of the world's evils. When you don't do anything, you don't pollute. All right? So they don't think of themselves as regular people who do terrible things. They don't pollute. They don't ever, nobody ever gets hurt in their coal mine.
We seem to have lost Evan. We do have a caller coming in.
I'm here.
Oh,
he just suddenly dropped off.
This is Ray calling from Baltimore.
Yeah, hi, Ray. You have a question for Evan, our guest?
Yeah, I kind of had a question for him with regard to his stance on the speech Obama just gave in Israel, because I'm wondering exactly what would be his alternative to striking some kind of peace accord for a two-state solution between these two countries.
Right.
How do you expect to resolve this?
I don't believe the Palestinians want peace. They want to. They've made it clear. They continue to make speeches in Arabic that everybody in the media knows, everybody in the government knows. They continue to make very clear.
I'm not asking for an assessment of the Palestinian people. I'm asking for your policy.
Yes, here's my policy. You get as strong as you can. You kick their ass as often as is required. You bloody their noses when necessary. And you do exactly what you do when you have a vicious bully living next door. You don't try to give the vicious bully more money, because he's just going to use that money to try to kill you. You don't give that vicious bully more land, because he's just going to use that land to try to kill you. I'm sorry. I wish you were otherwise.
So you're saying we should physically push them off the land?
I'm saying we should physically protect Israel, the land that is Israel.
Don't be obtuse. Be specific.
I'm not being the least bit obtuse. I'm giving you a point blank, straightforward answer. You protect the borders of Israel, and whenever there's a threat, whenever they're building a threat, whenever you find a terrorist plot about to murder more Jewish children,
you're going to leave this looming threat on Israel's borders. That's your solution.
Let me speak. See, this is a very big problem with leftists, is they think that because they don't like war, that the alternative to war is peace. But the alternative to war is not always peace. The alternative to war is sometimes genocide. The alternative to war is sometimes marching quietly into a gas chamber. If the other side doesn't want peace, then no matter what policy I come up with to try to appease them, it's only going to make them stronger and do nothing to bring about peace. Sorry, there won't be peace.
Your roundabout answer is your policy alternative is war. Which fits exactly with what I know about conservatives, is that you only have two policy prescriptions.
Get rid of this idiot, please.
All right, I just muted.
All right, because the man's an idiot. I never once said the word war. I said what you do is you protect the borders. But he this is how liberals think, because they think that because they want peace, because they have lived a life so protected where nothing can go wrong. They don't know that the opposite of war is not always peace. The opposite of war, if we had said to Hitler, how many more pieces of property can we give you until you stop trying to murder us, that would not have brought peace. At some point, yes, it requires war. But I didn't call for war at this point. I called for protecting the borders so that those who want to wipe the Jews off the planet, because they cannot live with infidels anywhere in the world. This is one of the things that kills me about the liberals. Listen to them like one angry Jew who says we're the cause of their terrorism. Okay, let's grant them that. Let's say Americans are just such evil, horrible people that we provoke these lovely, lovely people into becoming terrorists and hijacking airplanes and murdering stewardesses. And let's say the Jews of Israel are such horrible people that those lovely Palestinians have no choice but to blow up children in kindergarten classrooms. Okay, well, why are these Muslims murdering Hindus in India? Right now, let's give them. It's because the Hindus are horrible people. They provoke those lovely, lovely Muslims. Why are they killing Christians in Egypt, the Coptic Christians? Well, the Coptic Christians must have provoked. And they look at all these places around the globe, and they know about them. They know about the massacre in Mumbai. They know about the massacre in Beslan. They know about the genocide in the Sudan. And yet they will intentionally make themselves stupid. They will intentionally ignore the facts that they know in order to defend evil. That's in my book. That's what I answer in my book. Why it is the schmuck on the phone with you just now ignored everything I said, ignored all of the evidence that the Palestinians don't want peace, acted like a five-year-old child who said, well, the opposite of peace is everybody just play nicely together. Because they're not allowed to think. They must believe the Palestinians want peace, and in order to uphold, in order to cling to that infantile notion, they have to intentionally make themselves stupid.
Yeah, now, what unfortunately our caller is not paying attention to either, recently Israel did make several concessions giving land to the Palestinians, especially along the West Bank, which is only 11 miles between the new West Bank and the ocean. That's all there is between that strip, effectively just basically cutting Israel in half. And every time they gave more land, that land was used to launch terrorist attacks and missiles into Israel. It wasn't used to create peace. They used it to wage a stronger war against Israel. So Israel has made concessions, has sought peace time and time and time again. And every time they give in, what they concede has been used against them to kill more innocent people. So peace can only be accomplished if Israel stands strong militarily and say, if you even think of trying to attack us, we will take a preemptive act and just decimate you. So if you want peace, live side by side, then we're going to keep ourselves strong and we're going to be watching you.
Right. There are other indications as well. There are things that a government does when it's preparing its people to live in peace. It tamps down the vitriolic rhetoric. It adjusts the teachings in the schools to prepare children to live in peace. Not only have the Palestinians never done any of that, any of it, but it's the most Hitlerian, Hitler youth, Hitler-motivated ideology on the planet today, Islamism. And everybody in the government knows, everybody in the media knows that these hateful Hitlerian speeches being given in Arabic are 180 degrees from any kind of conciliatory lie they spit out in the face of liberals in America who are too stupid to recognize the lie.
Yeah, and they're even using our own cartoon characters against us.
Mickey Mouse in a kindergarten classroom, they had a Jew kill Mickey Mouse. All right, everybody knows this, but that's not salient to the storyline because that would say that the Palestinians are bad people. But the reporters aren't allowed to say, the liberals aren't allowed to believe that the Palestinians are bad. So they know that story, but they ignore it, and instead they say, well, it's because a Jew built a sunroof onto his house in East Jerusalem. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mike, you have an input on this.
I got a lot of inputs on it. Well, I think number one is, I think Ray was asking for an alternative.
There is no alternative.
There are a lot of alternatives, Evan. One is which the Palestinian people themselves have to come to an understanding, maybe build themselves a republic.
But that's not my policy. That's not Israeli's policy. That's Palestinian policy. The question to me was, what would my alternative be? I would love it. I would love if tomorrow every Palestinian said, I want a Jeffersonian democracy and the Muslim Brotherhood didn't shoot them all dead. I would love that.
That ain't happening. I think the most powerful people within the Muslim community, they're no different than Jesse Jackson and many others. They make their living. They make their money off continuing.
You and I have a fundamental disagreement here. A fundamental disagreement. And I think this goes back to a very American notion that everything comes down to money. I think there'd be a lot more money for these people to be made, and I think there'd be a lot more personal satisfaction and a lot more hero worship of them if they were to step forward and help their people live a good life. So the idea that they are the equivalent of Jesse Jackson, you know, just kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, screwing their people just a little bit to put more money in their pocket, I don't buy. I believe they're Islamic ideologues who believe that the infidel is a filthy offspring of a pig and a monkey, and that their intention is to drive them into the sea, not so they can drive a nicer car, but because they're evil people.
Well, I mean, that's, we have a lot of that. A lot of that is accurate, right? And a lot of that's accurate in real life. I mean, there are certain racist people we can't help, but the power, you are correct, too. If it were a prospering economy and the people of Palestine were doing well, making a living, that's great. But then that surrenders a lot of their power. And what these money-hungry poverty pimps don't want to do is surrender that power. The war is...
Let me address that. Look, there's absolutely no way to know the answer to this. You know, I because you're paradigm fits, but I don't think that, you know, it's about cause and effect. Just because the effect is there, I don't agree on the cause of it. I believe the cause of it is that they are Islamic fanatics, you know, who wish to create a world ruled by Sharia law, and that they would like Osama bin Laden, who would live in a cave to bring this about. They're willing to live in similar poverty. They may be much, much richer, but it's still a crappy place to be, you know, to be king or whatever. I believe it is ideologically driven. I don't just think they're whores.
Oh, we have just like, I think Mike is thinking of people such as Gaddafi, who ended up making all these palaces and gathered all this wealth. Arafat did the same thing. So you have the power resting with the ones that can grab the best wealth. Meanwhile, they stay in power because they spread this Islamic terrorist propaganda.
Well, the people who put them in power are also want to keep them down. I mean, Arafat didn't rise to power just because he's, you know, he started out as a busboy. He killed Americans. And Mr. Abbas is no, I mean, people think Mr. Abbas is like a John Kennedy. People are so stupid. But as our host said, people watch too much of the media. You know, I believe the opposite on every story. Even if they show a story of a nice Boy Scout helping an old lady across the street, I believe that the story is he beat her ass. That's what I think.
You know what?
I just
the most recent lecture that I gave to the Heritage Foundation, which was just this past Wednesday, takes my unified field theory of liberalism, the four laws and the three corollaries, but essentially the two that I gave you at the top of this show. They were raised to believe that indiscriminateness is a moral imperative because it's opposite of discrimination, and indiscriminateness of thought doesn't lead to indiscriminateness of policy. It leads to siding always with evil, failure, and wrong, and how that applies to the mainstream media and how it's led them to get literally every major story of our lifetimes, not just wrong, but as wrong can be, diametrically opposed to the truth. And guys, in every case, their mischaracterization servicing the evil, failed, and wrong, and disservicing the good, right, and successful. Let me just give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. If you're my age, and I don't know how old you guys are, and obviously I don't know how old your audience members are, but if you're my age, try to think back and remember how stunned you were, stunned at the collapse of the Soviet Union. How is it we were caught so completely unawares? Empires don't collapse in a day, a week, a month, or a year any more than they're built in a day, a week, a month, or a year. So how is it we were caught so unawares? Because the media did not do a good job of informing us as to what was actually happening. But not only were we caught unawares, but even as it was beginning to collapse, the media was telling us the Soviet Union was a co-equal superpower, tied for first for the most powerful and viable nation in all of human history. Think about it. While they were telling us the Soviet Union is tied for first, in reality they were crumbling to non-existence. This is not a little bit off. This is diametrically opposed to the truth, and in this case the mischaracterization making an evil empire appear stronger than in fact it was. All right, can I give you another one or two examples just to show that there's a pattern?
You're good anyways. Back. Go ahead.
I didn't even know you guys were still on the phone. I thought the interview was over at 2:45. I was just talking to myself. Every one of us, think back to the 1980s when the media was telling us that Japan was an unstoppable economic juggernaut. This as they were about to plummet into what is now a decades-long recession. Unstoppable economic juggernaut, decades-long recession. That's not a little bit off, folks. That's diametrically opposed to the truth. In this case, the mischaracterization making a non-Western culture appear stronger than in fact it was. You know, we can go to the rise and spread of Islamic fascism. How many of us were stunned to learn after 9/11 that Islamic fascism had already taken over one-third of the globe? How many of us were stunned when we learned about the true just horrors of their atrocities all over the globe? How is it we were so unaware? Because not only was the media not telling us what was happening, but they were telling us, and they continue to tell us, that Islam is a religion of peace. The most Hitlerian ideology spreading around the globe is a religion of peace. That's not a little bit off, guys. That's diametrically opposed. In this case, the mischaracterization servicing the rise and spread of the most Hitlerian ideology on the planet today. I can give you 10 more such stories.
Yeah, it's like Brennan still insisting that jihad is a spiritual journey.
Right.
Excuse me? Those two planes. Into the World Trade Center, the plane into the field in Pennsylvania, the plane into the Pentagon, those were spiritual journeys. Well, I'll send your spirit on that journey because this one is not going to be going that direction.
Right on.
And
yeah.
It's really
funny you brought up the fall of the Soviet Union. I was young then, but I remember thinking when I heard of the fall, the Berlin Wall, I thought like a bunch of the old-timers from the Communist Party, like, grabbed big bags of the Soviet Union money and split, or Russia's money, and they had no money. So that's kind of an accurate statement. I was thinking, like, here's this rich country, but, like, among six people, they stole all the money and split down, and then the country collapsed, having
right.
no clue of what you were saying. It's as we thought. We thought in the 80s, Japan was just going to flourish forever. And same thing.
I mean... Yeah, but how could we get it so wrong? How could people whose jobs, whose careers, whose years in the university studying criminology, whose years making contacts within the Soviet Union, whose years of walking into stores and seeing the shelves empty, walking into the meetings, doing what journalists do, basically they're intelligence officers in a different guise, their job to report send dispatches back, reports of inside information. How could they have gotten not just that story, but literally every major story of our lives? They reported that the Tet Offensive was a back-breaking defeat for freedom and liberty, when in truth it was a war-ending defeat for the most murderous ideology on the planet today. Every single one. They got not just wrong, but as wrong as wrong can be, diametrically opposed to the truth, and always, guys, always, always, always to the benefit of evil, failure, and wrong, and the detriment of the good, right, and successful. And my book, The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks, which your listeners can get at evansayet.com or at amazon.com, explains it all.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the Tet Offensive, because something happened the other day on CBS. I don't know if you've ever watched this show, The Great Race. It's not.
I'm certainly aware of it. It's been on the air a long time, but no, I don't believe I've ever watched it.
It's called Amazing Race.
The Amazing Race, yes.
Yeah, they have this episode set in Vietnam. And of all things, they set the clues at a memorial of a B-52 in the middle of a lake. And if anyone remembers Vietnam, this B-52 bomber crashed. It was shot down, crashed in the middle of the lake, and I believe two of the pilots were killed. Several others were taken prisoner and ended up in the Hanoi Hilton. And they have this race glorifying this monument, which is a monument to anti-Americanism. And then they further on in the show, that wasn't the worst part, they further on go where they have a performance done of a patriotic song, a Vietnamese patriotic song that extols the virtues of the Communist Party. It's underneath the banner of Ho Chi Minh as they wave communist flags. And they're telling the contestants they have to memorize the words of the song. Now, Bob Beckel is a liberal person that's on Fox News. He's on the 5 at 5 o'clock. He saw this. And he went ballistic. God bless the man for doing this. He is calling out CBS. He is demanding an apology, telling CBS that they owe an apology to all of the veterans.
Okay, but here's the question, Annie. Here's the question. Why? Why did these producers, why did these, they're not evil people. I know them. They're my neighbors in Hollywood. They're not stupid people. They knew enough to pick those monuments. Why is it that the modern liberal will champion that the evil? And meanwhile, if not exactly the same people, certainly those who share their ideology will be outraged about the Pledge of Allegiance in the classroom here. You know, it's because everything is diametric. It's 180 degrees. They are pro-evil and anti-good in every single way. Every single way. And it's not because they're evil. It's because of the rules of the unified field theory of liberalism. It's because when you have been raised to not discriminate between right and wrong, good and evil, better and worse, then anything that society deems good can only be a reflection of society's bigotries. Why should they say America is good if America isn't anything special? Meanwhile, Vietnam, we would argue that the North Vietnamese were bad. So now it becomes their job to show that the North Vietnamese aren't bad. You know, let me give you another example. This one's not in my book, but it's in the next book that's coming out, which is volume two of The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks. I'm a big Springsteen fan. I think that in many ways, when it comes to social issues, not issues, but in people's lives, just poetry, he's quite great. But when it turns to political, he's a typical modern liberal. And he has this song, Born in the USA, probably his most iconic song ever. And it's autobiographical. It's supposed to be about what it's like for every individual born in America. And he says, born down in a dead man's town. Well, no, he wasn't. He was born in a suburb of Philadelphia. And then he gets kicked. And then it's just horrible. And he gets beaten. And then he does something. He gets into a little hometown jam. So they put a rifle in his hand. Well, actually, he never even went to Vietnam. But the next line is the key here. He says, send me off to a foreign land to go and kill the yellow man. That's what the Vietnam War is about, according to Bruce Springsteen, and that's why he's such an adored and perfect liberal that he's a guest in Obama's White House. But here's the thing. Springsteen had to have known when he wrote that song. He simply had to have known that the South Vietnamese had yellow skin too. So, in fact, we were to fight that war not to kill people with yellow skin, but to protect people who happen to have yellow skin. And, in fact, if he thought about it at all, he would know that the North Vietnamese were just a proxy army for the white guys in Moscow. So, in fact, we sent Americans off to protect the yellow man from white men. It's 180 degrees. But because he wasn't allowed to think any deeper, he wasn't allowed to think about the evils of communism and the greatness of freedom and liberty. He wasn't allowed. The only thing, if communism and freedom are one and the same, they're equally good, then the only explanation available to him is racism, which is why liberals are constantly calling us racist. Why, no matter what you say, they will call you a racist, or a bigot, or a homophobe, or a xenophobe. Because if you're not, if everything is equally good and equally right, the only reason you would side with good is because you're a bigot to think it's good, and the only reason you would side with evil is because you're a phobic who's afraid about nothing.
Yeah, I completely agree, because I do remember the fall of Saigon, watching that in horror, as all these people knew that their freedom was going to be taken away. Tried to climb the embassy on board the hill.
I remember.
That is something that's been burned in my brain. And I was in high school.
Annie, we're coming to the top of the hour. Is that it? Is that going to be it for me?
We go until 3:30.
Oh. Okay. I hope my voice.
Evan, you're in a hurry to stop.
No. Well, I just need to take a breath.
Well, I'm going to give you a breath to take. I'm going to change the subject just a little bit. You were talking about how the progressives have this intolerance. And something Rand Paul said the other day that perked my ears up. And Rand Paul is known for his libertarian leanings and so forth. He said, and I quote, I believe a Republican Party that is more tolerant and dedicated to keeping the government out of people's lives as much as possible would be more appealing to the rising generation. And on the surface, that sounds like a really good statement. and then began to think. And then I came across, I knew something in the back of my mind was bothering the heck out of me. And then I came across this article written by Bob Siegel, who was another talk show host. And as I read his article, all of a sudden the light went off and said, that is what was bothering me. It was the code word, tolerant.
Right.
You know, and it's as if the Republican Party has to change into something that is more tolerant of, say, gay marriage.
Right.
Instead of standing firm in affirming that marriage should only be left to the states and between a man and a woman. And my argument has always been in that direction. Hey, listen, if you live in a state that wants to have, you know, same-sex couples, there is the legal recourse that the government offers you called a civil union.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I was going through this, I came across another article that a judge in New Jersey, and I said that government has no business defining the word marriage, because the second you do that, you intrude on my religion, and then you will mandate that my religion must perform, you know, gay marriages. You know, can you imagine now going into a mosque and saying you must perform a gay marriage?
Yeah, well, no, I can imagine going into one. I can't imagine coming out of it.
Well, I use that as an extreme example. But there was a judge in New Jersey just last year made a ruling against a Christian retreat house that declined permission for a same-sex civil union ceremony to be conducted on its property. The judge said the Constitution allows some intrusion into religious freedom to balance other certain important social goals. So what I predicted before, that government will then force religions to perform same-sex marriage against their religious beliefs, and it has occurred. And when the second I heard tolerant out of Rand Paul, I'm saying, number one, he's lining himself up for the White House, and number two, he's opening the door for government to recognize same-sex marriage universally and then intrude on our religion.
Right. Well, tolerance, it absolutely is a code word. And I'm surprised that the gentleman used it, because there are synonyms for it if what he just meant was the begrudging acceptance of behaviors that are legal, but we don't personally approve of the begrudging acceptance of certain behaviors. But that only means certain behaviors, and tolerating intolerance is not tolerance. See, liberals can't discriminate between what is good and what is evil, and therefore they will tolerate evil. And that's why that's become a horrific code word. I'm truly surprised that Rand Paul hasn't been challenged on that publicly and asked for a clarification, because everybody knows it's a code word, and I'm just wondering exactly how he meant it. You know,
tell you why. It's because not everyone's as smart as Annie to have picked that up. Most people are morons, including those in Washington. So I think Annie picked it up and researched it. I think it went over everyone else's head.
But yeah, perhaps. But even, you know, there are a lot of other people there, and that word is such, you know, such a touchstone to the left. Annie, go get your scoop. This is, you know, go national with this one.
Actually, I can't take credit for it, because I said I caught it, and then I started trying to find articles about this speech, and I came across this Washington Times article by Bob Siegel. So, you know, he scooped it. I'm going to pass the word.
Political parties, whether it's Republican or Democrat, are just not tolerable on anything. You either, in essence, Republican, no different. If you don't think like them, somehow you're not really one of them. I mean, it's just, that's just how they are. That's why they're a party, because most of the people think along the lines of who they are. There are minor disagreements, but other than that, I mean, if you don't think in 80 to 90% like they are, you don't really get welcome.
Well, but that makes sense. You know, that simply makes sense. Look, I'm not a Republican because there's a benefit to me to having an R next to my name as opposed to a D. In fact, in Hollywood, it's really almost a kiss of death. Here's something I find extremely interesting. I borrowed it from Thomas Sowell and adapted it just slightly. But if you name me one position a person holds, almost with 100% accuracy, I can tell you every other position that person holds. Right? Did he oppose the liberation of the Iraqi people? Then he's pro-abortion. Is he pro-abortion? Then he's against the Arizona immigration bill. Is he against the Arizona immigration bill? Then he's for expanding government research into embryonic stem cells. Is he for then just one policy, I can name you virtually with almost 100% accuracy. And there's a reason for that. And this comes from Thomas Sowell's book, A Conflict of Visions. And we have different ways on the left and the right of seeing the world, including at its very core, not just government, but human nature. The liberal believes the human being is born morally perfect and then is corrupted by evil forces within society trying to use him for their own agenda. If that's true, then all we need to do to create paradise is retard the child's moral and intellectual growth at a time before he gets corrupted by society. Right, this is the heart and soul of my thesis. The time when they retard the child's growth is the second he enters their clutches, the second he enters the public school, the private school system, the second he enters kindergarten, because that's the first time they can get their hands on the children. And they retard their moral and intellectual growth at the level of the five-year-old child. The conservative, and therefore the Republican, but the conservative believes the human being is born somewhere in between good and evil with a propensity for both and everything in between. Therefore, he needs society to teach him how to tamp down his darker emotions, tamp down his more evil aspects, and to grow the goodness within him. So it's diametrically opposed the role of society, the role of government. Let me give you an example. Everybody says, well, why can't our why can't the parties work together to solve our problems? But let's say that both sides want to prevent the next terrorist attack. Both sides want to prevent the next 9/11. Well, the liberal who believes that the terrorists are basically good people who are provoked to commit these atrocities seeks to eliminate that provocation. They seek to be nicer to the terrorists. They seek to bow down before their leaders and spit in the face of their opponents in Israel. The conservative believes, no, the way you prevent the next terrorist attack is you punch the terrorists in the nose, you bomb their sites, you embargo their ability to get weaponry, et cetera, et cetera. So now, what is the middle ground to be found? We both have the same goal, preventing the next 9/11-ish attack. What are we supposed to do to find middle ground? Do we bomb them on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday and send them presents Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday? There is no middle ground. It's diametrically opposed. And our policies on the right may not always be always right, but our vision of the world upon which we build our policies is right. The human being is not born morally perfect. And the bad guys haven't always been provoked. And the good guys haven't always had unfair advantages.
And I completely agree with that. You know, it's going back to that word tolerance. You know, the left wants tolerance. And if you are not tolerant of abortion, of illegal immigration, if you're not tolerant of same-sex
terrorists,
then you must be hateful. And
well,
that's
here's
not,
why. Here's
they don't
why.
Understand. Instead of allowing us to explain why we don't agree with these positions, not because we're intolerant, but because we have certain moral codes that we believe in, certain religious beliefs, certain political beliefs. It doesn't mean we hate. We're not
right. But here's why. Here's why they think you hate. Because the opposite of indiscriminateness is the evil of discriminating. So any policy other than theirs, they call it tolerance, but it's really indiscriminateness. That's I don't know how Rand Paul means it, but when the liberal speaks of intolerance, he means speaks of tolerance. He means indiscriminateness, and anything other than his policy is not only wrong; it's evil. Or as Sowell put it, disagreeing with the liberal renders you not merely in error, but in sin. And there's another major aspect to my book. And geez, if I talk any more, they don't have to buy the books. I've given them everything. right? But right after, right at the beginning of the modern liberal era, the world became something so spectacular. It was leaps and bounds. It was a 5,000-year leap from any and every other time in human history. Think about this. From the dawn of time until just before I was born, people had to think. They had to be right. They had to be smart. Listen, they didn't have to be articulate. They didn't have to be clever. But they had to be right in order to avoid disease. Suddenly, just before I was born, disease was wiped off the planet. What disease do you and I have to worry about? Polio? Smallpox? Chickenpox? Just not all that long ago, the flu wiped out two-thirds of a continent. Now it's a three-day paid vacation. Right? The other things you had to be smart to avoid, hunger, poverty, and physical pain. Well, hunger, now if you find a dollar in the street, you go to the 99-cent store and you pick up 3 days' worth of ramen noodles. Right? So you don't have to be smart. Nothing bad has or can happen to 99.9% of Americans. Even poverty has been so wiped out that just to call somebody impoverished, we had to make up a whole new definition, a definition that kings and czars and popes would have traded for. You don't think a king from some African nation 200 years ago wouldn't love to live in a one-bedroom apartment with central air conditioning and heat and a refrigerator and cold, hot and cold running water and cable television and all the things that even the most impoverished American has. So having grown up in this world where nothing can or ever has go wrong, they think the utopian answer is the appropriate answer. If there's nothing bad that can happen from illegal aliens, not only should you let them all live anywhere they want to live, but anyone who would stop even one of them must be a bigot. Why won't you let that man come into this country if nothing bad can happen? So that's their assumption. Like the guy who called early on the phone, I think his name was Ray. He doesn't understand that bad things can happen when you make a bad peace with people who want to kill you. So he thinks the opposite of war is simply not war. Come, just try and make up a policy, do something to, so that they'll stop trying to kill you. But there's nothing you can do. But they don't understand this because they grew up in a world unlike anything else in America, post-World War II, which is exactly the start of the modern liberal era in my writings. They grew up in a post-World War II America where disease, hunger, poverty, and physical pain had been wiped out of their life. They never had to think about it. Then many liberals go into professions where they don't have to be smart. They have to be clever. They have to be articulate. The professor has to be articulate as he pontificates. But he doesn't have to know what he's talking about because he doesn't do anything. And when you don't do anything, you don't have to be smart because nothing can go wrong. So there's a clear, definitive distinction between those who leave the childish world of the schools to enter professions where you do things and those who enter professions where you don't do anything. Those who go into the rhetoric industries, journalism, academia, entertainment, and Democratic Party governance, they never mature morally or intellectually. They continue to live as articulate children in a world where they just don't know anything go wrong because nothing ever has, and because of their industries, nothing ever can. Those who then go on into professions where you have to be smart. You know, Bruce Springsteen singing a song about what he thinks it might feel like if he were actually a fireman doesn't have to know anything about being a fireman because he can't get hurt. But the fireman has to be smart because if he's not smart, he can get burned. And when he does get burned because he's a rookie or whatever, he learns a lesson and gets smarter. Springsteen never gets smarter. He just writes another song about what he thinks it might feel like if he would ever actually be a policeman.
Yeah, it's funny because you mentioned Springsteen because I retired from NYPD. And I was always amazed at how he was the darling of the working man. And yet he produced nothing. There was no product. No, there was nothing in exchange. So I'm hearing some words. So I'm paying you good, hard-earned money that from the toil of my back, where I did produce something
right.
That was tangible, and giving you now my money for nothing.
Right.
And yet,
I am truly a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. Anybody who knows me knows I quote him constantly, but it's always about interpersonal relationships. But what I recognized The liberal hates working people. The liberal thinks that working is the most god-awful thing a human being can do. Because having been born morally perfect and having learned, as the book says, not my book, but another book, all I ever need to know I learned in kindergarten, the goal of the liberal is not to better himself. Okay, that's the goal of the conservatives, to spend his life trying to better himself, spend his life trying to better the world. But because the liberal cannot discriminate, he doesn't believe in the existence of the better. So suddenly, in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, the purpose of a human being's life became not to better yourself, but to be yourself. So there's no growth that needs to be done. And how can you be yourself if you have a job? I don't want to get up this morning. I'm tired, but I have to go to work. But if I go to work, I won't be being myself. And so to the liberal, having a job is the single worst constraint on their life's purpose. And if you listen to Springsteen's lyrics about work, they all make that point. Not only do they make that point, but they all go a next step and say, and because you are constrained, you're about to become horrifically violent. Every song, there's a song called Factory, where Springsteen goes line by line, day by day, minute by minute, through the day of a factory worker. And it ends like this: end of the day, factory whistle cries, man walks through these gates with death in their eyes, because their soul has been stolen from them. They got nothing, they can't be themselves, they got death in their eyes. And it ends with, and you just better believe, boy, somebody's going to get hurt tonight. That's the work in life. So it's having a job steals your soul, and then you go home and beat your children. The entire purpose of the Democratic Party is to make sure you never have to work. Because if you do, you'll have no soul, and you'll go home and beat your kids. Look at Sandra Fluck. What is this woman's claim to fame? What makes her a Democratic Party icon? What gets her to get a call from the President of the United States and a slot at the Democratic National Convention? This is a woman who is in her fourth decade on this planet and has contributed nothing to society, nothing. Her entire claim to fame is that, having never left the schoolyard, she's famous and wonderful and terrific because she's demanding more free things for herself. That's the Democratic Party.
I got an older brother like that, and he's in his sixth decade. I know what it's like. I mean, every family has to have one.
Right, and that's the entire Democratic Party. That's the entire concept behind the Democratic Party. Do everything you can to make sure people do as little for themselves as possible, because if they have to do for themselves and they can't be themselves, if they have to go to work, that's going to constrain them from their life's purpose and get them as many free things as you can from the schmucks who have jobs. That's the Democratic Party.
What I find amazing is that taking pride in doing a job well is no longer something that's reinforced with our youth. You know, But it used to be the Ayn Rand belief that if you're going to do something that you're going to be proud of, even if you don't 100% like the job, but take pride in it.
But Annie, when nothing is better than anything else, what do you take pride in? If you're an artist and you paint the Sistine Chapel or the equivalent thereof, and they give an award to the piss Christ, all right, what do you take pride in when nothing is better than anything else? Pride is a function of discriminating thought. You take pride in having done something well. But when you don't believe in the existence of the better, there is nothing to take pride in.
Yeah, and then you end up with someone like Lindsay Lohan, where it's all self-indulgence and self-gratification. That's the right thing. Instead of good moral value and pride in self, is not the right thing.
That's correct. It's the wrong thing. Listen, the Democrats, the modern liberal movement, was founded on two concepts. Western civilization became great based on the notion that you do what is good. You use your intellect and you learn more and more over time to discriminate. You're a discriminating thinker to seek out the better and then use your tools to accomplish the better. but the liberal doesn't believe in the existence of the better. So he was taught two things. Instead of better yourself, he was taught to be himself. And instead of being taught to do good, the slogan, it was the slogan. It was the slogan of the movement. If it feels good, do it. That's what the liberals believe, because there is no good. You can't use your intellect because your mind is tainted by your bigotries. So eliminate your mind. Don't do what is good, because that requires you to think about what is good. Don't do what is good. Do only what feels good. And by the way, that's why they remain at the level of a five-year-old child, which is why my book is called The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks. It's all there. It's why people call it the Unified Field Theory of Liberalism.
Yeah, and your book is on your website, evansayet.com. It's also up in Amazon. So if anyone wants to get it, there is a link on the show page. They just click on it, and it'll take it directly to your site.
And everyone should buy this book. I'm telling you, Annie, there's a reason. And I started to say this earlier. When I went to Washington, D.C. to give the first of what is now these three lectures to the Heritage Foundation, I went in as a complete political unknown. I gave this lecture, and there's a reason why out of all the speeches that are given every day in Washington, D.C., in one venue or another, every television clip, everything on YouTube, every article that is written, every book that they have to read. I mean, Washington, D.C., people get inundated. It's tons and tons and tons of different. Why this talk, this 47-minute wonkish talk, became the most viewed lecture in Heritage Foundation's history. And it's one simple reason, because it's right. Because it's right.
Ed, I'm just catching up on something that just popped up in the news, and this is absolutely outrageous. There's a Pakistani fertilizer maker whose chemicals have been used in 80% of the roadside bombs that have killed named American troops in Afghanistan, and they are now seeking U.S. taxpayer subsidies in order to open a factory in Indiana. Is that not outrageous? That's just coming across the wires.
You know what? It may be outrageous, but it's not shocking, because the modern liberal will invariably side with evil, invariably side with failure, invariably side with wrong, invariably side with the vulgar over the beautiful. Not just the piss cross, but the song F.U. is nominated as one of the five best songs of the year at the Grammy Awards. By what criterion? None, except that vulgarity, filth, and antisocial behavior is great to the liberal. And everything that is bad is what they champion. So the idea that they're going to bring this mass murderous product to America, that's Barack Obama. That's the Democratic Party. That's modern liberalism.
Well, Evan, we're down to our last 7 minutes here. This has been an absolutely fascinating hour and a half, and it's been very challenging. Don't you agree, Mike? Did I lose
my
co-host?
Sorry, say it again.
I was just trying to get a hold of my co-host. It sounds like you may have dropped off again, unfortunately.
Well, why not? You know, he wasn't saying anything.
Well, no, he's got a lot to say, and it's interesting to hear. Interesting to hear all sides.
Yeah, you know, I didn't mean it that way. I meant that I wasn't letting anybody speak. It was self-deprecation, not anything else.
Well, Evan, as usual, you're always welcome back anytime. And let me know when your book comes out. You've got to send me a copy.
Well, the book's out. The Kindergarten of Eden: How the Modern Liberal Thinks is out. It's the number nine on Amazon. When part two comes out, of course, we'll do it again.
Absolutely, Evan. Thank you so very much for joining us. It has been a blast.
My pleasure, Annie. Anytime.
You have a great weekend. All right. That was Evan Sayet. His website is evansayet.com. And unfortunately, we lost my co-host. But I want to remind everyone that on September 14th, we're going to have Lieutenant Dan week number 4 here in Beaufort, South Carolina, to benefit the Independence Fund. If anyone is interested in finding out or making a donation, even if it's only a dollar, go to ldw4.org or go to independencefund.org. And it looks like I got my co-host back again. Mike?
Yeah, I just got bounced. I don't know how. I just bang. I heard you say, there's 7 minutes to go, Mike. And the next thing I'm like, hello, hello. But anyway,
All right. We got a good show coming up on Tuesday. I don't know if you've ever heard of the soldier Corey Claggett, but he's been in prison because he followed a direct order. And our show on Tuesday will be about freeing Corey Claggett. He's coming up for a parole hearing, clemency hearing in April. We'll have his mother, Melanie, on the show. And I'm hoping that his attorney will also be coming on to discuss the case. It's something everyone should read up on and check out. So it's going to be Free Corey Claggett on Tuesday. And on Friday, we're having Kerry Zuris coming back. He was a conservative policy wonk under the Bush administration. He was on with us, I believe it was about 2 or 3 months ago, and he is coming back on. So we got a good lineup coming back.
Great. It was definitely an interesting show.
Today was. It was challenging. It was interesting, especially our friend Roy from Baltimore that called in. Got a little contentious there, and it was fun. Definitely fun. So I hope everyone has a healthy, happy week. We hope that you join us back again on Tuesday. And if anyone has been looking for me posting the events in Facebook, Facebook has sent me to FITMO. So I am no longer, I am unable to send out invites to the show through Facebook. They slapped my wrist. They said, no, 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 you can't send it out to these people when the people are signed up on my Facebook page because they want to know about the show. Matter of fact, I was up there posting last night, and there wasn't anything nasty I was posting. I was just, you know, throwing a couple of updates up because I was watching the news and saw some stuff. And next thing I know, Facebook comes popping on the screen saying some of my posts are offensive. And if anyone's been on my Facebook page, I dare you find an offensive posting on there.
I think that's our rivals, Annie. I think that's our rivals at work. I don't think that's anything you've done, but it's the ones we see. So,
oh well, I stirred up a hornet's nest somewhere, and
well, you got 64. We sent out 6,400 invites, so
yeah, that's just about 6,500 invites went out. So hope everyone enjoyed the show. If you have, go on to Blog Talk Radio and where it says click follow, follow me there. Or you can try the Facebook page, but your best bet is to go to our new website, southernsense.webs.com. That's southernsense.webs.com. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me because Facebook has slapped my wrist. So I hope everyone has a healthy, happy weekend. And until then, be safe and God bless to each and every one of you. See you again next week.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American. American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up? Don't sit down. Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.